Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 23rd, 2002. Today's session is titled, Reform of the Criminal Justice System with Focus on Prison Institution from a Christian Perspective. Session 1, The Journey Begins in Central America. This is presented by Gerhard Fischer, and the number is FIG 2002-01. Let's listen in.
Gives a talk, has to tell them. Microphone that we should start taping so they can start taping.
Say it loud.
Are there lots of other people coming or is it just a noise out there?
They're having post house training for new staff.
First of all, sisters and brothers, good afternoon. What I'm going to do, and it's a three-session thing. I mean, it's going to be on tomorrow and then also on Thursday. And it's my journey towards recognition of a flawed and unjust criminal justice system, especially prisons, and our responsibility as disciples of Christ to be part of its reformation. And today I'm going to talk about my journey through El Salvador and other places, and as I begin this journey towards where I become conscious of the fact that I've been called to work for reformation of the criminal justice system. I use God's prophetic justice and gospel grace as the parameters I use to judge the criminal justice system. Now, I know that isn't everybody else's parameters, but for me, that's what I go by, you know, God's prophetic justice and God's grace. So, I'm going to tell you a little bit of how I got started as a youngster and as I grew older. First of all, let me say this is not supposed to be a monologue. I give you permission to interrupt at any time if you have something to add, something you know about what I'm talking about, and also if you differ with what I am saying. So please interrupt and just give your thoughts. But this has been a faith journey for both my wife and I myself for many, many years. And my preparation for what I call the journey began with my father, who was a very just human being. And he taught me very much about right and wrong and justice in general. He became sort of a personal witness to me as I grew up about things concerning other people and how we treat them and justice and so forth. In the 1950s, I returned from the Navy after the end of the Korean War, and I came to my congregation very enthusiastically, and I wanted to so very much be part of my congregation life. And what I found out, and maybe you've had experiences in this yourself, what we were saying was not what we were doing. I mean, we had good sermons, and we talked a lot about justice, and we talked a lot about the issues of the time, but we did little about it. Martin Luther King used to say the church was a light unto the world, a taillight, and that we usually came up behind the rest of the society after they decided that it was an issue that was worth pursuing, the church joined in, you know. And that's been my experience, at least, as a member of a congregation and so forth. And when I came out, I became a candidate I was then in the Wisconsin English District of the Missouri Synod, and I was a delegate to our assembly. And I remember I tried to take issues that were pertinent at that time. First of all, the Vietnam War, and secondly, the Civil Rights Movement. I tried to make memorials and have the church address these, but I got no support in my own congregation, and nobody wanted it. In fact, some people thought I was very unpatriotic because I opposed the war, you know. The two defining moments in my life have been, first of all, the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Movement. They had a lot to do with my thinking about justice and what the church stands for, should stand for, and they have sort of modeled my life. And there were two human beings that I had many mentors, but I've had two that have stood out for me, and they've stood out for me from afar. I was not intimately involved with them. One is Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and uh, His writings and his personal example were, of course, a great influence in my life. I read The Cost of Discipleship when I was in high school, and it had a deep impression on me. It also tore me apart. How could anybody possibly perform what Dietrich was talking about in The Cost of Discipleship? How could anybody? And as a 17-year-old, how did I feel I could possibly be a good disciple of Christ? Because there were such high standards that were part of The Cost of Discipleship. And of course, I followed his life as a young person, and of course, I've read almost all his books. I have quite a few of them myself, and he set a standard of nonviolence, and also he went against his own pacifism by joining the plot to assassinate Hitler. And this was entirely against his own philosophy of nonviolence. And when he said, but he could not stand aside and let other people do the dirty work for this awful, awful system, under Hitler and the Nazis. So he felt he had to participate. But then he threw himself on the mercy of God because it was going against his own tenets of nonviolence. The other mentor is Martin Luther King. And for me, he was the prophet of my time. And his words and his personal integrity have moved me for many, many years. And he was also faithful to his ideas when he opposed the Vietnam War, and his own people told him, don't get involved, this has nothing to do with black people. But he said he could not but be involved. And he was also a proponent of nonviolence. And those two men have sort of given me an attitude about violence, and I have tried over the years to be a nonviolent person, which isn't always easy, and we slip, at least in word and deed, if not in actions. So that was sort of a preparation for myself, and my journey began in Central America, and I'd like to tell you about some of the things I experienced as a person who went there on numerous occasions. And the first thing that I was involved in was Nicaragua, and this was when our nation opposed the revolution in Nicaragua and the Sandinistas, and I was very much impressed with what the Sandinistas had done. They increased literacy from 30% to 80%, much with the help of teachers from Cuba, and they went into in the countryside, and everybody had a chance to learn how to read and write. And that was a momentous thing for, first of all, a person who's just had a revolution. You don't usually teach your people how to read and write, but that's what they did. And they also had a health system, which I know of because friends of ours, a doctor friend of ours and his wife, who was a physical therapist, went down there every year. And their medical system was considered one of the best in the Southern Hemisphere, and it was free, and everybody could have it, and it was a beautiful thing. And then, of course, we had the Contra War, and the United States supported the Contras, and they literally destroyed all the good work that had been done in Nicaragua. And I made two journeys to Nicaragua, one with Habitat for Humanity. We went down to build homes in Nicaragua, but the other one I did on my own. And I started to become angry when I saw what I had observed as being a wonderful things that were occurring in Nicaragua. They could have been, had they been supported by the United States, they could have been the jewel of Central America, because they were doing so much, and if the United States had supported them, rather than calling them communists and trying to defeat them, if we had supported them, they could have been a jewel that would have spread out into all the other Central American countries, because they were doing so well before the Contra War. Again, anything you disagree with, anything that you differ with, anything you want to add, please jump right in. So then, in the early 1980s, I became interested in El Salvador, primarily because I read a lot about the situation there, and our church in Milwaukee has a sister relationship with Rutilio Grande, which is a city in El Salvador. And Rutilio Grande was the if you saw the movie Romero, he was the priest who was killed with his two companions on the road. You remember the movie, any of you, Romero, the movie? And he was the priest who was killed, Rutilio Grandi. And he has a community named after him. And he was, of course, a legend in his time, things he tried to do for the poor. And of course, because he was doing the things for the poor is why he was assassinated on the road, you know. A little bit of history of El Salvador. It is about 5.5 million people live in El Salvador approximately. And of that, way over 1.5 million were refugees, many of them in the United States and Mexico and other places because what happened during the Revolutionary War there. And there are seven families. It was an oligarchy, and seven families owned almost 90% of the land and the possessions of El Salvador, these seven families. And of course, they didn't treat the peasants very well. And they were self-sufficient as a country. They could feed themselves until our multinationals went down there and they asked them to grow coffee, cotton, and sugar, among other things, which are not necessarily make for good meals. Consequently, El Salvador became insufficient in feeding itself. And of course, exporting these products to the United States. So you're all familiar with the Banana Republic idea. Well, this was similar. And it's interesting to note that in El Salvador, 60,000 highly armed military with helicopters provided by the United States, with all kinds of things that were necessary for war given to them, they could not defeat 10,000 ill-equipped revolutionaries. And eventually they wore them down, and they had the peace accords. But when I was there, somebody said, you know what that big building is? It was the biggest building in San Salvador, which is the capital of El Salvador. And it's the largest building. It's one of those glass buildings you're all familiar with. And guess what it was? It was the military bank. And the military, now the commandantes, became millionaires because we gave El Salvador $1.5 million a day for 5 years. And most of that went for arms and to line the pockets of the commandantes and the generals of the El Salvadoran army. And it was quite interesting to see this building in front of us, and it's by far the biggest building in El Salvador. What we did in El Salvador, and which we've done in so many other countries, is provide a safe environment for our multinationals. You know, when our multinationals go there, they don't have to do anything about the environment. Nobody can unionize. Nobody can have fair wages. So it's really a wonderful place to make money. And when our multinationals go down there, of course, they're protected because we have provided the military with all this arms. So they can literally protect the multinationals from the people. So, I made four trips to El Salvador. On the first one, it was one of the main intentions of what we were doing was to go down there to be accompaniment. Have you heard anything about that over the course of time? People from Canada and from the United States and from Europe went down there to accompany people back to their land. This was still while the war was on. And of course, without that accompaniment, they would just confiscate their things and they would not let them return to their land. So we were a group of about 50 people, some of them from Europe, some from Canada, and some from the United States. And we were reaccompanying people back to the land in San Vicente. There's a big volcano, inert volcano there. It's called San Vicente Volcano, and that's where they had their land. And when we went to, we had a caravan of about 20 trucks and things and vans, and we were stopped by the military and surrounded by really young guys with their arms. They had their brand new uniforms on, and they had the automatic weapons, and they surrounded us, you know, and wouldn't let us proceed. And what they had done in the meantime also was confiscate all the trucks that the campesinos were taking back to their land, you know. So a couple of the people that were leaders in our group, they went to the police station or the military station, which is the same thing, and negotiated to get us to go on the trip and take our people back to their land. And it was an ongoing, and nothing happened until we sent telegrams back to the United States to our friends there and asked them to send telegrams to the ambassador. our ambassador in El Salvador and also the president of El Salvador. And sure enough, after a couple hours, two military people in civilian clothes, who I'm sure were members of the CIA, came and without negotiation, they just said, let those people go. And we were allowed to take those people to their land. And we got there well after midnight, and we were out in this field, and all we had was candles. And we had brought some Eucharist utensils for doing the Eucharist. And so we had the Eucharist out there in this darkness with candles and out in this farmer's field, you know, and it was probably the most meaningful Eucharist I've ever celebrated with the people from El Salvador that were there and all the other folks that were there from the United States and Canada, so it was very meaningful. And the second trip I took was to when the peace accords were signed, and I went there, Lucy was along, I believe, and we went there and we saw the generals from the revolutionaries, the FMLN, come by plane and land, and then they started to do the process of preparing the peace accords. So that was after all that effort by all the people who were involved in it, that was quite an ending to what we thought would be the ending of the oppression, and that we would have true democracy in El Salvador. The third trip Lucy and I both were what we call UN observers for the election, and we were trained to be observers, and Lucy and I both went to a little town in El Salvador that was very small, and maybe 1,000 people or less. And the elections, we were at one time, we had to take the boxes and open them, make sure that nothing was open ahead of time, to make sure that the election would be fair. And I should say, for the most part, the election itself was fair, but the pre-election thing was pretty much all focused around the Conservative Party. And the United States gave the Conservative Party 9 million Cordobas, and they gave the FNL, which was the opposition, 500,000. And they were also already the wealthy people, and they had the radio and the television and everything else, and they had helicopters fly over and drop leaflets, and the FMNL had no money to do hardly anything. But they did quite well in the elections, and they won a lot of small town mayorships and so forth. But it was interesting, the elections were not to start till 8 o'clock, and so we went and opened the packages and were ready at 8 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, they were already starting to form lines. And there was this old man. He looked old. I mean, I'm sure he wasn't as old as he looked, because when you work as hard as the peasants in Campesino work, you age quickly. But he was the first one in line. I was told he was there at 5 o'clock. And when he was allowed to go in, he was grinning from ear to ear. Bring back some memories. Sorry. So, at the end of when Lucy and the other folks went back, I decided to stay because I'd always wanted to go to El Mazote. How many people know what happened at El Mazote? Would you raise your hands if you know what happened at El Mazote? Not too many of you do, but it was a dark moment in the history of the United States, believe me. El Mazote is a small village that's on the eastern end of El Salvador, almost, and you know, completely on the eastern end. And it was a town of between 900 and 1,000 residents. And the military came to that town, and it was the Atlacotl Battalion, which is their Green Berets, the crack outfit, one of their best outfits in the army. They came. And when Monterosa, who was the colonel of that battalion, he landed with a helicopter on this little hill, and he observed his battalion slaughter over 900 people, including babies. They literally bayoneted babies and killed them, and they herded people into the houses, and then they machine gunned them in the houses. They burned all the roofs off all the houses. They burned down the church. And this was a community that had nothing to do with the war. This was an evangelical community which did not have anything to do with either side. But they wanted to give a lesson to others that they would not oppose the military, and they would do nothing to help the FMLN. So they literally slaughtered the whole community except one person. Her name was Rufina. I forget her first name, but she hid in the bushes when it all started, and she heard all, including her own children, screaming. And she witnessed the whole tragedy. And Raymond Bonner was a newspaper man from the New York Times. And he walked in with another reporter into Almazote and did an article about the whole incident. And President Reagan had it squashed and had it hidden and would not allow it to be printed. And Bonner was taken back to the New York Times and given a desk job, and he eventually quit the New York Times because of that. But nobody, they did, because at that time, President Reagan was looking for a greater aid for El Salvador. And of course, something like this to be exposed would have been difficult for Congress to pass for more aid when they were doing such drastic things with all this. So anyways, those were the, and I remember coming there in the car, and it was just the pine trees similar to here, but it's a very tropical climate. But very, very quiet, very, very pastoral, a little town. Nobody lives there. And when I understand people are moving back. But when I was there, it was an empty town except for two cows I saw going through the town. And they had since then unearthed the bodies of the people, because they denied it. The military denied it, the United States denied it, that it ever happened. It was a communist plot that we to tear down our association with El Salvador. But they went in, some people from Denmark, I believe it was.
Argentina.
People from Argentina who were experts in digging up graves and so forth came and unearthed all the bodies and counted them, and sure enough, it was well over 900 people who had been slaughtered in that town. Well, anyways, I came there, and we both went our separate ways, and I walked around, and I climbed up on the hill where I imagined Colonel Monterosa, who was the darling of the United States military because he was such a ferocious fighter and had a tremendous record militarily. And where he stood on when he landed in his helicopter and observed his battalion doing this gruesome thing. And I walked up there and I sat in the grass and I wrote a poem. And I cried. So sorry.
It's okay.
I sat there and wrote that poem. And I thought of all those people and all those babies and all those children who were killed during that slaughter. And I was beside myself. I was so angry and so taken by what I was observing and seeing that this is where it took place. And then I started putting things together. We also saw what happened in Guatemala. Arben Barbenz, the democratically elected president, was overthrown by our CIA, with the help of our CIA. And for 30 years, they had military, on and off, they had military regimes, which caused the death of 200,000 Guatemalans in that war. There was a civil war there, too. And Bishop Girardi, who was the Bishop of Guatemala, did an investigation of all 200,000 deaths. Who had caused it? Was it the military? Or was it somebody else? And they recorded this in a monster book, a series of books, every incident. And they had hundreds and hundreds of volunteers who went into the communities to dig out these things. And he published this and gave it to the human rights organization in Guatemala. And the next day, he was assassinated. And guess who assassinated him? A colonel who was a graduate of the School of Americas. The person who assassinated Romero, graduate of the School of Americas. The people who killed the Jesuits, almost all the officers and men were graduates of the school. First, maybe I should say, do you know what the School of Americas is? Does anybody not know what the School of Americas is? It's on Fort Benning, and we train foreign soldiers there. It's a beautiful school. We spend $20 million a year doing that. And we also spent $20 million just recently to make it look nice. And it's about, I would like to go to school there, it's so beautiful. And but they train foreign soldiers. And I always question, why does the United States training any foreign soldiers? There hasn't been a war that I know of in South or Central America where people were fighting against it. Uruguay didn't invade Paraguay in the last, you know, generations. And but we were training soldiers, and what do you think they were for? They were for one thing, to go back and kill their own people in order for multinational companies like that we have in the United States to have a comfortable place to do business. And we, the reason they could do that was because we supplied the military hardware for every all the dictators at one time or another received aid from the United States, including Noriega. Noriega is a graduate of the School of America. Pinochet has his sword hanging at the school. Pinochet. That's another instance where we interfered, and a democratic elected president was taken out, and we had 30 years or 40 years of Pinochet, you know, who massacred thousands of his people. Well, anyways, Girardi was assassinated the next day after he printed this, and it's just another instance, again, of a person who's from the SOA, the School of Americas, and I'll talk more about that at the next session, because what I did there eventually led me to prison, and I want to talk about that and what life in prison is. Excuse me, life in prison is. In the third session on Thursday, I will talk about reforming the system. I think our prisons are considered some of the worst in the world, you know, that are maximum security prisons. So I want to talk about that. Yeah. So I just open it up for questions or anything else that you'd like to talk about. Or if you have some questions of me of what you heard, and maybe you want me to enlarge on it or something. But
okay, so School of America is strictly for the Western Hemisphere, the Western Hemisphere, where the school, Central America, South America, is that
yeah. What it is, it's usually where we've got problems. Now, guess where we most of the trainees for the School of America come from? Where's our biggest problem right now in Central?
Is it Colombia?
Colombia. Mm-hmm. Most of the soldiers who are trained there, the officers, are from Colombia. When there was a problem in El Salvador, most of them came from El Salvador. When there was a problem in Nicaragua, they came from Nicaragua. So it's a constant flow of people who go back and literally kill their own people. That's the only thing they're good at, is that kind of problem of killing. And handbooks that were released and read, and they teach what they were teaching these people was how to torture and how to extract information from people, and that was one of the courses. And of course, we say that we're teaching them human rights and democracy. Well, there's one course of I think 2 or 3 hours on a 10-month course where we supposedly teach democracy, and they don't have to take it, and most of them don't.
Oh, I was just wondering about when you mentioned that Reagan squashed a story, but I'm wondering whether he had Alzheimer's at the time, and maybe George Bush Sr. was the culprit.
Well, I don't say that it was his aides, of course, Elliot Abrams, who I think is one of the nastiest people I've ever known, who was very influential during that time of the Contras and everything else, and he was indicted. And I think he did spend some time. Now he's back in our government. I don't know if you knew that. Elliot Abrams is now part of our government again. He's got a job, and they always take care of those people. But no, I think it wasn't Ronald Reagan. It was his administration. He didn't sit down and say, okay, let's keep the school open. It was his administration and the people who wanted that school. We almost closed it a year and a half ago. And the reason we didn't was because the Pentagon wants that school open. So they had Madeleine Albright, Colin Powell, the general from the Fort Benning, and a whole host of people go door to door at the House in the Congress and ask the people to, the Senate had asked to close it. And we lost 12 votes, 6 who didn't show up for the vote, and 6 who reversed their vote because of what they had been told by the Pentagon to keep it open, you know. So we lost, and we only lost by 3 or 4 votes that time, you know. So we've been very close to closing. Is that answer? I don't know if I answered your question.
Well, yeah, I was just thinking of how George Bush treated the Christic Institute. They sued it and
talk ran. About it.
Well, Christic Institute. Well, Jack Nelson Pallmeyer addressed us about that several years ago, and it was kind of a small group of lawyers that went after, and they brought class action suits against certain things like Ku Klux Klan and that Kerr McGee and things like that. And then they got involved with the Iran-Contra thing. And
well, there's been a lot of that.
And then we used to get their literature all the time. And then they were saying that the Bush administration was suing them for $1 million, and they didn't have $1 million. So
that but that helped shut them up.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's been a lot of pressure put on groups that that attempt to. We've been having demonstrations at Fort Benning for 12 years. The first demonstration was one priest who climbed up a tree with a bullhorn and announced to the entire camp, you know, that of the injustices of the School of America. And since then, it's grown. I'll be talking about that next time in the next session about the SOA, School of Americas, which has now been renamed, and also the whole issue of my time in prison. I'd like to let you know what I experienced in prison, because the next session I will talk about how to reform it, and I will tell you a little bit about what prison life is, and that'll be the next session. Any other questions?
Is that the new name of the School of Americas?
Yeah, that's the new name, really fancy. It doesn't lend itself to an acronym. Mm-hmm. The Western Hemisphere Institute for Strategic Cooperation, and we call it the SOA clone. And the one thing that has always impressed me and has led me to where I am is this quote from Scripture from Hebrews, where it says, "Those who are in prison, oh, remember those who are in prison as if you were there in prison with them." And I'm going to talk about prison ministry to some length, because I think it's sadly lacking. You know, there isn't a whole lot of good prison ministry, especially out of the Lutheran Church, you know, overall. You know. Any other questions?
What is the rest of what your t-shirt says?
Well, I don't really know what that says, but
we don't
can
forget.
You read it?
We don't forget?
Yeah.
Is that what it means? Yeah, I don't speak Spanish. Which was a real detriment trying to be in Central America. And not. So Lucy and I went to a school in Waukesha County, and being our age, we found it very, very difficult to learn. The kids were, and a lot of them were there who were renewing their Spanish, you know, they spoke Spanish, they were just renewing it. The kids were way ahead of us, you know, and we just sat there kind of the dunces, she picks up languages much better than I do, but I was sort of the dunce of the class, and I gave up.
You could tell them about that silhouette.
This is so dramatic. This is the only memorial there is to, I should tell you, if you want to look at this, the New Yorker had the full New Yorker is all about Alma Zote.
Date?
Yeah. You can look at it and you can pass it around. It's a beautiful expose of what happened. You know, it's the truth and the excavation of the people. And then this book is written by Mark Danner, and it's the Mazote, the massacre of Alma Zote. And it's another book that if you're interested in what happened there.
What was the year that happened?
81? 81. Yeah, it's on here someplace. So, yeah. But I have become so traumatized. I really can't be loyal to this country, that a country I love, when they do these horrible things. I mean, I'm you know, between a rock and a hard place. I want to be loyal. I want to be a good patriot. I did serve in the military. Maybe I wouldn't if I knew what I knew now, but I did, and I have great difficulty. Especially what's happened since September 11th and so forth. So I have real great difficulty in when I try to address, especially the whole business of patriotism. You know, I think I'm a patriot. I mean, I love my country, and I want it to be the best country that God has ever made. You know, and I certainly would affirm that. And I voted every election, and my father taught me that when there's an election, even if there's only 20 people that come, I'm one of them, and Lucy and I are the only ones that go sometimes out of a whole neighborhood. If it's for the school board or something, you know, nobody goes, you know, 2% show up of the whole population. But that's the kind of American I think I am, that I'm very interested in seeing that things are good, that and are good for the common good. That's very important in my life. that I respect the common good. And I should tell you, and I will repeat it at the next session, you know, if you read Matthew 25, one of the judgment calls, and there were six of them, and he talked about feed the hungry, you know, give water to the thirsty, and clothes, and take care of the sick, and so forth. And the last one is what?
Visit the prisoners.
This is where when they separated the goats from the sheep, you know, and that was one of the things he talked about was visit the prisoners, you know, and we don't look at that, and I don't think we get that preached from the pulpit that that's a responsibility as disciples of Christ that we have, that we ought to go to visit prisoners and write to prisoners, and you know, it's a terrible place to be, especially if you don't get any letters, you know. And so I want to talk about that also a little more about the ministry of that.
Where were you in prison?
Oxford Federal Prison in Wisconsin.
Oh.
It's in middle of the state of Wisconsin. Most of the people who go there are from Illinois. Yeah, and I'll talk about that too. It's a very interesting phenomenon of the people who have come from the state of Illinois to Oxford Prison.
If there are any people who probably could not attend the next two sessions,
yeah,
that you guys.
I did a report. It's a very long report, and it was from my experience in prison and also a tremendous amount of reading. And it's called The Moral and Humanitarian and Fiscal Necessity of Reforming the Criminal Justice System, especially the prison institution. So if you're not going to be here for either the next two, you're privileged to take one. But I say if you take it, it costs quite a bit to print these, you know, at printing costs today. And we had 250 copies made. My synod helped me do that, you know. And so our Peace and Justice Committee of the Milwaukee Synod is doing that for the whole year. We're involved with prison reform and criminal justice reform. But if you like one, you could take one. I've got quite a few copies. I would like to save them so that people don't read them before I talk about it. Otherwise, you'll know more than I do. But any other questions or comments? Or I hope to see you all back here. I've got some interesting things to talk about, especially if you're interested in what prison life is like and what happens in prisons. And I was, in a minimum security. And I can't. I will talk about the fact what it means to be in maximum security, and that is absolutely horrible. But anything else? I don't know. What time is it? Time to quit?
That's a good time. 45 minutes.
Yeah. What?
We're
down 4:30. Yeah, 4:30. I don't know. We get a little time if you want to talk some more about some other thing that relates to this. It would be fine.
We go to 4:45.
Yeah, we go to 4:45. You know, so there is some time yet. Yeah.
What were you saying about that memorial on your shirt?
This one? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I forgot to tell you. This is a sheet of metal. It's just a sheet of metal. It's the only thing that identifies Almazote as having had a match. And it shows the two parents with their two children, you know. I mean, it's very poignant. I mean, when you see that. And there's a wonderful thing it says underneath, which I can't remember. But it touched me also about the fact that, you know, it's something to do with paraphrasing. It's something to do with, you know, as people die as martyrs, you know, they are always remembered, you know, and there's this host of martyrs that have died for causes, and they're just one of them, you know, this group of people at Almazote who were martyred for, you know, because of they were simple peasants, you know. But it's just a sheet of metal. It's just cut out of a larger sheet of metal and standing there as you enter the city. I understand now that people are coming back and living there now, and I read that someplace, and I'm thankful of that. I want it to be a bare place forever, you know. Rufina, that woman I mentioned who was the only witness, and she was hiding in the bushes, you know. She became a recluse for a number of years, and she almost lost her mind from having, you can imagine why she might have had that happen to her. She was, you know, and finally she came out and she, reporters interviewed her, and she told about all the things she had been through. And she has come on several occasions to the, you know, we have a vigil every year in November on the date of the Jesuit killings of the Jesuit priests who died in El Salvador. And that's when we have the crossing of the line, and that's when people get arrested. This last November, 43 people, of which six were Quaker students who were just visiting, and didn't they got swept up with the other people. And see, they now have built a fence. We used to be able to walk over. Now they built a fence, and you can't go in except if you go around and sneak around. Well, they were on the property, these six the students, and they were swept up with all the people who had gone around and did civil disobedience. We call it holy obedience rather than civil disobedience. We call it holy obedience. But they were swept up, and they had to go to court. These six Quaker students that were there to visit the SOA. And but of the people that all the rest either got, some got probation for whatever reason, I don't know, but we have the names. I have the names of all the people who were, one of them was a good friend of ours from Milwaukee who was arrested. She got 6 months and I think a $2,000 fine. Others got, one even got a year because he had other, you know, had done it before. And the people who have been arrested for this cause and spent time in prison far surpasses the people that have committed all these atrocities in the time they spent in jail or prison. By far. Very few of those people, the one who assassinated Archbishop Romero, he was a sergeant, spent a small time in prison and then was released. For assassinating the Archbishop in El Salvador, you know, can you imagine, you know, what kind of justice is that? That's like killing our president or something and then getting a couple months in prison and then being released. An interesting facet about SOA, too, we had a very sympathetic judge because he was a substitute for a previous judge who was over 90 years old and had a stroke. This previous judge gave maximum penalties every time somebody came up for the SOA, crossing the line. He gave maximum, the most he could give out, you know, 6 months and a $5,000 fine. This was the same judge who, after My Lai massacre, Lieutenant Kelly, you remember him? Anybody who doesn't know what the My Lai massacre was? Well, during Vietnam, it was a massacre of a city, and the Lieutenant Kelly was in charge of the troops who literally machine gun civilians and so forth, but that's another story. But he was convicted by a military court, and he was supposed to spend a lot of time in prison. Well, this judge exonerated him and set him free. He now has a major jewelry store in Columbus, where Fort Benning is located. Talk about justice. Here's a man who committed an atrocity, you know, and was so judged by a military court, and then is let go by a judge, and this same judge is the one who gave maximum penalties for everything that that people who crossed the line at Fort Benning. The people at Fort Benning, of course, they like us because when we come down, or when I was arrested, there were 14,000 people there, you know, and there's a lot of motels that have folks in. They love it, you know, it's part of their prosperity for me when we come down. But they also understand, they write very well, the newspapers there, about what's really occurring, and they're very honest about what happens, you know. Whereas the newspapers, you know, when they come to your town, there might be a little column in the corner someplace, and it's usually not very good for the cause, you know. So but they do real well there, and they try very hard to be honest about what's happening, you know. And we had an interesting experience. One of our women, who is a wife of a pastor of ours who just retired, she was down there and she met with the chaplain for Fort Benning, who's a Lutheran pastor, and he has become a company man, you know, as they say, and he does the line that that the school puts out. He professes that also. So she had a long discussion with him. Accepted what he was saying, but also said that our information is different, you know, that we can document that so many of these graduates have done that. The thing that really bothers me the most is that not once has our country talked to El Salvador or Colombia and said, if those people commit those crimes, we want you to put those people in prison, and we want you to apologize for the fact that you took our money, our tax money, to train them, and then they have done none of that. They have never said a word. Our government has never said a word about all these atrocities. When they killed Archbishop Romero, no, the government didn't say, hey, what happened there? You know, and we found out it was a graduate of the SOA. That didn't matter. And it didn't matter to them. I mean, they haven't said a word of apology or asked the countries to apologize for using those soldiers that we have helped train. We are democratic things and human rights things are doing these massacres. Have you got your hand up?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, these kinds of things are still going on. You're talking about Colombia, and I was down there. And the stories I heard are that those kinds of atrocities are still going on in the villages, maybe not to the extent...
Oh, maybe more.
Maybe more.
Because you don't hear about
it. Yeah, and we hear very little about Colombia.
Yeah, most of the graduates from the SOA are now from Colombia. And you know what the biggest export from Colombia is? What do you think?
Used to be drugs.
Cocaine.
Oil. They have the largest. They have the largest reserves in the Western Hemisphere under Colombia. Tell them the story.
I have to tell you.
It's so cute.
One of us came back in Colombia, and she was telling a group like this about her experience down there. And one of the women in the back, a very wise woman, she was saying this out of the corner of her mouth. She says, "What the hell is our oil doing under their rainforest?"
I think sometimes we think that. Our country does think that's ours, you know, and we have a right to it because we have all these automobiles that need gasoline, and we need a lot of that oil. So, you know, we feel we have a right to interfere in Colombian politics and also to support the war against. They also have a guerrilla war, which is not a very nice one because both sides are committing many drug things and committing many atrocities, and it's not a very nice war. But the other thing that's so devastating in Colombia is the spraying. In order to get rid of the cocoa plants, DuPont has produced, what's their big product?
Roundup.
They've added other things to that, and they sold it to Colombia, and they use it to spray the coca plants. And of course, there are peasants tending those plants, and that's been the people in high elevations chew coca all the time because it gives them energy, and it's not a drug, that it's going to affect their what they're doing, but they do use it continually all over the countries, the Andes and so forth, where people chew coca because it gives them energy when they're at high altitudes. But that's what's happened. They literally spray those fields. Many people, they break out in sores, and they break out and some of them die. Because you can imagine, if I came in your yard and I started spraying you with Roundup, and then I've added a few other things that are even more dangerous than the Roundup itself. And we're literally taking our planes, we've given them helicopters, of course, and they go across those fields. And you know, it would be wonderful if we could spend that $1.3 billion that we have given already to Colombia for the military. If we could spend that in converting the farmers from coca plant to something else, you know. But it's so profitable compared to growing vegetables. You know, growing coca makes, and these are very poor people, and if they can raise a few extra dollars raising coca, they're going to do it. It's only in their self-interest, you know. And it's not their problem that people in the United States use it. It's not their problem. I mean, but anyways, it would be wonderful if we could say, okay, here's a $1 billion. Give it to those farmers so they can convert from coca growing to something more, more in common, what we'd like to have, maybe vegetables, or so they could feed themselves or something else, you know. But that's not the way we operate, unfortunately. Very sad. Okay, if you have nothing else, thank you very much for coming, and I hope I'll see you tomorrow as I continue my journey.
Thank you.
Thank you.